So, Eric is from University of Maine, and he is going to talk about multiple stresses and the case for ecologically based weed management.
Yeah, so generally when you think about managing weeds, it's really pretty simple. You've got your weed right there, right here. You know, and you do something to kill the seedling, right? And basically this is what I would call like a one hammer approach. And it's, you know, most often it's being done with herbicides. If you're not using herbicides, you're probably going to be cultivating, you know, and you might end up with something like this. With the herbicides, it's a hell of a hammer, right? It works really well. It's super efficient. There's a reason why, 98.8% of the corn acres in the country are treated with one or more herbicides and so on, right? Okay, no disagreements there. With herbicides, you know, despite how wonderful they are, they clearly have problems. And if you're, you know, watching the news or reading papers in the last couple of months, you'll see some of these problems. And you know, and I'll call attention to one article in particular. This is a news piece based on a very thought-provoking article that Adam Davis and George Frisfald just published this summer in Pesticide Science. It basically asks the question: are herbicides a once-in-a-century method of weed control? The reason is that, you know, even though you might see new hats or new things every quarter, there hasn't been a new mode of action for 30 years. You know, imagine if you're dealing with antibiotic drugs and we haven't had a new antibiotic for 30 years. You'd be kind of scared about that, right? So anyway, so there's certain problems. If you're not using herbicides, and this is kind of where I come from, and so I'm going to give you some examples that, if you're from Iowa, you're going to be looking at some of the examples I'm giving you like I'm from Mars. But I work in, this is Maine. It's a small developing state in the most northern eastern part of the United States. It's mostly forested, so it's mostly trees and moose, and then lobster out here, which is why most of you would come to visit. I've worked for about 20 years with these small scale diversified organic farmers, and in some ways, yeah, I kind of left where I grew up in the Midwest, and I just went up and hid in the forest so I could kind of do what I wanted to. If you are managing weeds without herbicides, most often you're going to be cultivating, and that's a super simple substitution, right? You get rid of the herbicide, and you get a tractor, and you drag some metal bits through the soil to try to kill those weed seedlings, which is really simple. The problem with this, though, is if you measure the efficacy, if you go out, you put down a quadrat, you count how many weeds are there, pull the quadrat up, go and cultivate, and measure the weeds again. The efficacy, so the proportion of the weeds that you kill with a cultivator, it's nowhere near what a herbicide is, right? You know, I'll show you a fairly large number of plots we did. So 139 spots in a 5-acre field. Typical, you know, row crop cultivator, the efficacy, and we actually used, you know, a surrogate weed here. This is a condiment mustard. So all of our weeds were the same species, all the same cohort. And you can still see, even with one species, one cohort, what the distribution was. You know, average 67% efficacy. And you could be like, it depends whether you're an optimist, like, woohoo, that killed 67% that's out there. Or you look at the glass, you know, half full, and you're like, oh, shit, you know. Look at how many survived. And that ends up being a really big problem for physical weed control. And so this efficacy being constant over a range of densities, it means that if you start off with a whole lot of weeds and you only kill 67%, you still have a lot of seedlings left. And, you know, the easiest thing to do then, and what a lot of my farmer friends do, is they just go through again and go through again and go through again. And you take out 67% each time until you approach whatever you know, they just look at the field and they're like, okay, that's a satisfactory density and I'm going to stop there. You know, you contrast that with a really excellent herbicide, and I'm, I haven't studied herbicides for a long time, but I'm guessing you don't take something to market unless it's killing, what, 98% pretty consistently? Otherwise, you're going to have grouchy farmers calling you back. You just wouldn't accept this as a commercial enterprise. But this is what the organic farmers live with. And so you got these problems. And if you then go to some of these farms, and this is a good friend of mine, Mark Guzzi, been an organic farmer for almost 20 years now. And we take soil cores and do a germinable seed bank assay, and we look at the number of germinable weed seeds per square meter to a depth of 10 centimeters. Yeah, we did 12 fields on his farm, and he's like the winner. I've done this for years now, and we've never had a number that high before. And he's kind of proud of that. He tells people, oh, yeah, Gallant does that seed bank shit, and I got the highest ever, even in all of New England. So this is what happens. You know, you get this sort of low and variable efficacy if you're just focusing on the weed seedlings. This is not that atypical. I mean, I will point out he's hauling out some really nice looking carrots there, but imagine the cost that of the added harvest cost of trying to haul them out of a field of crabgrass. You know, it's just terrible. So you got these problems if you don't have herbicides, if you're just cultivating. And then the solutions, you can cultivate more, and that's absolutely the simplest one. And I am not going to judge if you're a farmer and that's what you want to do, have at it. You know, you got more fuel costs, more time, it's riskier. And in northern New England, it's going to get even more riskier with changing climate, where we have more variable and bigger precipitation events. You can cultivate better, and Steve showed us a bunch of examples of that, and there's a fair bit of good technology, most of the tools coming out of Northern Europe. So there are ways to cultivate better. Or you can start with fewer weeds, so that when you go out and kill 67%, maybe that's it. And so that's what I'm going to focus on. You don't need me to do that. Steve already talked about that, so I'm going to talk about this. How do you start with fewer weeds? And then you can't just focus on weed seedlings. You have to step back and start looking at the seed bank. You have to start looking at where those seedlings are coming from. And the seed bank would be the seeds that are on or in the soil, and the bank metaphor is pretty apt. And basically what we're aiming to do here is to sort of maximize our debiting of this bank and minimize our crediting of the bank. And it turns out that there are a lot of ways to do that if you take a broader perspective of weed management. So it's not that we would ignore managing seedlings. I'm not saying that. But we would sort of de-emphasize that. And then we'd start looking at all these other things that we know are, you know, working, affecting the dynamics of our plants. There's all sorts of things out there. So crop competition, we already know what's going to happen to weeds if we don't have a crop out there. We're going to have massive weeds. Can we preempt seed rain? Gosh, if you can figure out a rotation strategy that does that, have no seed rain for a year, then suddenly you can experience some losses of the seed bank. Manage to increase seed predation, or manage to deplete the seed bank by germinating them out of the seed bank. And if you are the... If you are sort of the seedling focused manager and you've got a great herbicide right now, you'd be looking at me going like, whoa, dude, you really are one of those elitist, you know, ivory tower dudes. Why on earth would I want to make my life more complicated, right? Basically, if you're using a herbicide, your weed management is solved. That's why everybody does it, right? So it's super, super easy. And what I'm talking about is not that easy. This is sort of like, you know, manager-based. You're managing ecology now, all right? So you have to think about, well, you know, the farmers that I work with that begin to do some of these things, they usually start choosing things that have multiple benefits, okay? How can I do something, you know, maybe if I'm trying to deplete the seed bank, maybe I'm doing it in the context of a cover cropping strategy that's going to improve my soil or some such thing. So multiple benefits, minimizing risk, and you do it because you don't have a choice. All right? You don't have any other choice if you want weed management to get better over time. So, and this is what Matt Liebman and I, 20 years ago now, wrote a book chapter called Many Little Hammers, sort of outlining this sort of multiple stress approach to weed management. And we're actually kind of proud about this because it's sort of in the vernacular now, kind of like, what is that called, like Kleenex or whatever? Like there's an article published on many little hammers for herbicide resistance control, and they didn't even cite us. So that tells you how, you know, it's just sort of part of the vernacular. Matt actually did most of the brain power in that, but I came up with the title. Anyway, there's tons and tons of hammers, and if you're an agricultural ecologist, these are the things that you would spend your career looking at. And we can, you know, there's loads of publications looking at all of these factors to manipulate crop-weed interference to the advantage of the crop and the disadvantage of the weed. Lots of those. You can go find as many as you like. Weed seedling control. It's not that we're going to stop doing that. We're going to still do that, you know, but we start adding things like flaming or mulching to prevent weed emergence. So there's lots of strategies to target the seedlings. And seed control. And that's what I'm going to focus on today because this has been sort of the core of some of my own research. Basically, three strategies ranked here in order of importance. If there's a way to preempt seed rain, turns out that even for a year, that can be really impactful for improving weed management over time. If the weeds seeds do get into the soil, the most effective way to get them out is to try to get them to germinate. And then thirdly, if all else fails, you can try to get animals to try to eat the seeds. All right, so that's what I'm going to go through next. So starting with preempting seed rain. And again, if you're in, this is in the context of recognizing that, you know, a system might need some diversity built into it. If you want to say, oh, I want to do ecologically based weed management, but I want to grow continuous corn. That's like a different room. That's just not what I do. And if you can figure that out, that would be awesome because we could probably, you know, use some of your techniques there. But this, you know, we're acknowledging that we probably can't have a system that looks exactly the way we do many of our cropping systems. That we need to, you know, program into some diversity to get opportunities to do things like this. All right. So starting with seed rain. You might ask the question like some of my farmers do, which is like, well, why would I bother to try to manage the seed bank anyways or preempt seed rain? Because you guys have told us that the seeds live in the soil forever, right? Weed seeds live in the soil forever. You learn that in Weed Science 101. And I used to, when I was brand new doing extension stuff, I even showed a slide once of like, oh yeah, Chenopodium album seed viability 2,200 years as shown in a archaeological pottery fragment or some damn thing, you know? So, like, I even get farmers to think there's no way you can manage the seed bank. Why bother? So, but it turns out I don't do that anymore. I don't tell them that. I show them this sort of thing. So if you look at, you know, seeds over time and you don't have any new seed rain, we know that for all of our weeds that we study, they experience this exponential decay over time. And the rate of decay is going to vary from species to species. So this is without new seed rain. So one cohort goes in, it's going to decay like this over time. It turns out that if you look at the half-lives for many of our really important weeds, so lamb's quarters, pigweed, many of our annual grasses, gallon soga, they have half-lives that are actually less than a year, which means that if you can come up with a cropping system strategy where you preempt seed rain for 1 year, you've experienced then a halving of your seed bank. And do it again, you've halved it twice, and now suddenly your initial conditions are way better than they were before you started. Now, again, this isn't going to work for everything because if you're out here with, you know, what, velvet leaf or, you know, you in the back, you're going to bring up radish, wild radish, oh, that's my problem. It's like, okay, it's got a terribly long half-life, so this doesn't really apply. But for many of our important annuals, it does apply. So, you know, I'll just give you a brief example that, you know, really drove this home to me. This is an organic field of soybeans where we had a wet spring. It's all loaded with crabgrass, so we got cultivated late and so on. And I thought, oh, we should test this, like, zero seed rain sort of strategy. So we went out, and I took my crew, and we just basically cleaned up some very large blocks of this. So we removed the crabgrass. We did it by hand or with some hand tools just to sort of see, well, what does zero seed rain do for a single season? And it turns out that next year, you almost didn't need to collect data. You could see our plots just driving by on the road. So we did some of this kind of stuff on farms too. So we'd go out to farms and if we had time, take the whole field crew out and we'd like weed big plaque patches on an organic farm, and the organic farmers would be like, oh, what are those crazy university people doing now? But then next year you'd walk by that part of their field and you could just see like, whoa, check it out. It's very, very different. We did, you know, we depending on the site, you know, you could show just some, you know, if it had some more persistent weeds, you know, maybe cut the seed bank in half the next year. But in some cases, it would reduce the germinable seed bank really considerably, just 1 year. Now, again, if you're saying if you're growing, you know, continuous cotton, this is going to be really hard to do. But if you can put together, especially if you're growing vegetables, there's lots of opportunities, lots of short-season vegetables where you can get crops out. Or if you're using a forage crop, you can imagine getting a forage crop off before you get weed seed rain. So, you know, it depends on the system how easy this is to do. But if you can do it, it's number one for reducing your seed bank. Number two, once the seeds are actually in the soil, the number one, the most effective way to get them out is to germinate them. And I wish it could be like that we could make them rot, that they could decay. And I've tried this in a whole bunch of studies. It's like one of those pet hypotheses that if you ever get one of those, you should drop it right away because it's probably wrong. But this idea of like enhanced soil quality, and it's got more microorganisms and the microbes are going to cause decay of the weed seeds. Oh, we tried it with wild oat and it didn't work. We tried it with like five other species in northern Maine and it didn't work. I mean, you could see tiny, tiny effects, but you know, on the order of a couple, less than 10% ever. Most of the time, no differences. So I've sort of dropped the decay and have focused more on germination. The people that taught me about germination are actually who I would call the best ecological weed managers in the U.S., if not anywhere that I've ever met. It just so happens that they farm with horses, but don't let that distract you. They have about 6 acres of organic vegetables in northern Pennsylvania. Two people, Eric and Ann Nordell, very intentional in the design of their cropping system in that they did not want to hire a bunch of young people to come in and hoe and take care of their weed problem, which is kind of another strategy that small organic farmers do, right? They're like, oh, you want to be an intern? Intern means sleeping in a yurt and crapping in the forest and hanging on to the wrong end of a hoe. But they wanted to manage their weeds by the, you know, without having a bunch of interns. So they knew that they had to have a weed situation that was staying the same or declining over time. It could not be increasing over time. And they did that by being very intentional in their crop rotation and cover cropping. So they actually call themselves cover cropping farmers. And if you're interested, they have some nice things on YouTube. Eric is an incredibly articulate speaker. But basically, they have they're land rich. They have enough land that they can afford to farm vegetables in half of it and cover crop and fallow the other half. In a typical field, it would go from a vegetable crop. In the second year, that field would be put into cover crops and fallowing. So soil improving practices, but most importantly are these fallowing events and the soil disturbance. That would then come back out and go back into vegetables and then back into cover crops. Maybe over time, they learned that they couldn't do their fallowing all at the same point in time, because if they did all their fallowing in June, they would shift for, they'd start having winter annual weed problems. So they started moving their fallowing and changing their cover crops to have different temporal diversity. So I visited their farm and I took the soil cores. So again, taking soil cores to a constant depth, we spread them in a greenhouse, water them. The soil ends up at a depth of a centimeter, so we can easily enumerate the germinable fraction of the seed bank. This is a typical farm in Dixmont, Maine. So that's actually Mark Guzzi's farm, the guy hauling the carrots out. This is another organic farm in more southern Maine. And then this is Eric and Ann Nordell's farm. And you know, you look at, this is their weediest field at their farm. And you know, this was the species. If you're a corn farmer, you might not know this, but it's a volunteer tomato seedling. Essentially, their seed banks are down below 500 germinable seeds per square meter. You know, the same sort of seed bank, if not lower than we achieved in a high-intensity Metribuzin paraquat cultivation potato-based system. You know, some people would say, and I'd be curious to see what Jenny thinks, you know, I've had some people say, like, oh my gosh, is that okay? What about the animals that depend on those seeds in the soil? You know, that you've depleted the seed bank. But They would counter argue that they're doing plenty to feed their microbes in that cover crop and fallow year, that they're you know, building their soil during that period of time. The key part to this is that they have a really well-developed knowledge of the biology of their particularly pernicious species and their ecology. And the most important aspects are the germination phenology of the species you're targeting. So the cover crop part of all of this is really, in my opinion, and Steve Mirsky and I did some of this a long time ago, the cover crop part of this is kind of like incidental filler. Sorry, all you cover crop lovers. From a weed management perspective, the cover crops, sure, they're fine, and we could talk about allelopathy and all that sort of stuff, and it's all great, but that's such a minor stress compared to, you know, plowing and tilling or disking and so on. So if you have your tillage disturbance timed when this species wants to germinate, you can cause a very large flush of it to germinate, and as you do that, you deplete it from the seed bank. Because once it goes from being a seed to a seedling, the seedlings are super easy to kill. You just harrow the field again and you kill them. So you've had a net then debiting of your seed bank. Likewise, knowing when you have seed rain is key to try to preempt that growth, so terminate that growth. You know, if you can terminate that, you know, whatever your cover crop is, before any weeds get to set seed in there, now you've not only had some debiting, but you've prevented credits. So one of my pet peeves when I review papers that have lots of cover crop stuff in is that people always say, oh, isn't this awesome? Look at the biomass of the weeds in the cover crop compared to the biomass of the weeds somewhere else. And look at how weed suppressive the cover crops are, and it's all that. That's really cool, but that's like completely irrelevant data, because what really matters is, did it get killed before it set seed or not? Otherwise, it's just biomass, and it's like a weedy cover crop biomass. You know, and you could even say it's like scavenging some cool micronutrients or doing something that, you know, you should think of it as like the weedy diversity to your hyper-dimensional cover crop mixture, right? You got everybody's into like lots of species in your cover crop mixture. Think of the weeds as being part of that, as long as you terminate them before they set seed. Okay, and then the last bit I will tell you is that seed predation. So if you do end up with seed rain, so this would be an example of, you know, winter squash, late season crop. Very typical in one of my experiments, we missed some timing and we had a heavy weed seed bank. You have a lot of weed seed rain right there. So what a typical farmer would do is basically haul your squash out of there, mow that field, till it, and put in a fall cover crop, because we all love cover crops, right? And it's like, and then you're like, whew, and hopefully you do all that shit before the neighbors came by to see it. And that's great, and again, I'm not a cover crop hater, because this is like doing all that catch cropping and doing all the other stuff that we like cover crops to do. But from a weeds standpoint, the weeds out there in that field are all going like, yo, that was awesome. That is so cool. Because you just took them all from the soil surface where they were like possibly eaten by animals, or at least much more likely to experience environmental conditions that might get them to germinate when they shouldn't. We call that unfortunate germination. And you just did this. You buried them. You planted them. You protected them. And so they're all like super happy for you. So if you leave them up here on the surface in any agroecosystem that people have studied, there's going to be something out there that looks at that as like a resource. I mean, heck, you can get amaranth right at your local co-op because it's some ancient grain thing, right? It's really good for you. So there's animals out there that recognize these ancient grains as being really healthy. You know, this is one that we have, Harpalus rufippes. We did some on-farm work where we compared this is a farm where he plowed in, you know, worked in and did a fall cover crop with tillage. And then we used a no-till drill to fall seed a cover crop. And we put out these large exclosures here. And so the exclosures are mesh that would protect the area inside that from having any animals go in there. So the idea is that inside we're protecting the weed seeds. Outside, the animals have free rein and they're just chowing all of those seeds, right? Because we're in no-till, we're leaving those weed seeds on the soil surface. And we did this, and the first year, it was like a complete bust, and we're like, oh, shit. They gave us a lot of money, which sounded like such a good idea, and it doesn't work at all. We had exactly the same germinable seed bank inside the exclosure as outside, so meaning that it seemed like the predators didn't do anything. The next year, it was like, this is awesome. Look at this. We have a lot of seeds inside the exposure, so really heavy seed rain, and outside we had 42% reduction outside. And if this ever happens to you, you should just stop right now and say, fully in 1 out of 2 years, seed predation is a massive way to reduce the seed bank. But we did it again, and it didn't work at all. And then I can't even make the slide because we did it a fourth year and it still didn't work. So it's like 1 out of 4. So why? And I wish it would have been like 12% or 8%. If it would have been like below 10, I would just be like, all right, predation, other people can study that. But when it does happen, it can be huge. What we don't know is what causes this sort of episodic thing. So then it gets into this role of ecology, the organisms, and we've done a little bit of work on that. But anyways, predation, when it happens, it can be big. The unfortunate thing is that it doesn't seem to be really consistent. The one thing I will say, though, is that there's probably not a downside from a weed ecology or weed management perspective to keeping those weed seeds up on the surface. There's no downside to that. This is the farmer I was working with, Rob Johansson, and he's so happy because this is April, and he's got this just complete sod of little lamb's quarter seedlings. And he's happy because they have, unfortunately germinated, right? April, if you're lamb's quarters, it's, too bad because there's going to be some harrowing coming on. Those are all dead. So he's happy because that's just a massive seed bank debiting process that just happened there. All right, so that's it about predation. So the summary points I want to make, if you're going to take away this major hammer of a herbicide, you better start thinking not necessarily about seedling versus seed, but seedling and seed management. You need to have a broader perspective on weed management. We just did some nice systems comparison of zero seed rain and mulching compared to just cultivation alone strategies. These sort of so-called long-term things versus a short-term thing. It turned out in onions even, these longer-term things like zero seed rain and mulching actually were economically advantageous even in the first year because the weed suppression was so great. And with mulches, you might be adding soil organic matter. Anyways, you have to sort of broaden your perspective. So getting back to sort of the title of the symposium, thinking beyond herbicides, I will say that, I think if we want to really think beyond herbicides, you have to have a little bit of a different reference point. If you want to say, oh, we want to have a corn-soybean rotation, or I want to grow continuous cotton, I want to do it without herbicides, I want ecologically based management for continuous cotton, I don't think you can do it. You don't have enough diversity. You don't have enough stresses. You're just going to cause such a buildup of the pests that are specialists to that system that it's just not going to work. You could try doing it with some enhanced feed physical weed control, but it's not necessarily that effective, although it's certainly gaining in efficacy and speed. And that hopefully you might think about this argument that multiple stresses, on the other hand, would support these systems where you're de-emphasizing seedling control and thinking about the concerted effort of all these stresses. The advantages of reducing risk over time. So those were the three main points I wanted to make. It turns out I had a guy come up and visit me last week from Boston, and he brought this thing, Turtle, the most highly funded Kickstarter of last year or something like that. And Turtle, $285 or $265, it's got conductivity sensors on the outside, so it's bumping into large transplanted crops. And then there's a conductivity sensor under the front, and when it hits a small weed, it turns on a little mini weed whacker. I mean, come on, it's adorable. It's got a little solar powered, it's designed by Apple, right? One button, it's turn on, set in your garden, walk away, go fishing. And they don't want to sell this. If you're a commercial corn farmer or cotton farmer, they don't want to sell this to you now. They want They want every home gardener in America to have one of these. Okay, and it's got lots of things that aren't so great, you know, and whatever, but they took this from an idea to this in 2 years. So just imagine what it's going to be like when you have, you know, hundreds of these things, and they're communicating with each other, and they're being, you know, they're all coming over to the weediest part of the farm, and they're like, you know, you've got the rescue bot that's coming out, flipping the one over that done. I mean, this is not that far off. And it has no negatives. I can't think of a single negative. You know, I told you all the downsides of cultivation. Who cares if the efficacy is 50%? It is ultimately patient. 50%, 50%, but it's out there all the time. No soil compaction. You get it to, you get some like gnarly ass tires on the thing, and it can go over residue and weed whack in high residue systems. You know, it's still pretty crude. There's all sorts of problems, but just think about where this is going to go. You know, and if you think about the fact that there hasn't been a new mode of action of a herbicide for 30 years, and how hard people have worked on trying to have a new herbicide for 30 years. This is where I put my money. Okay, that's it. That's the one that's going to put me out of business. Basically, it's because my whole many little hammers thing is all predisposed on this idea of cultivation not being so great and having all this risk and all of that. And so when the robots come, I'm done. All right, thanks a lot. If we have questions.
Nobody's in this room afterwards, so I invite everyone to ask Eric any questions or ask Todd, Jenny, or Steve any questions they might have for them as well.
Steve!
Hey, Eric. I enjoyed a lot of party. I was in the competing.
I know. I saw that. Yeah. I heard you.
Exactly. You know, maybe I'm kind of maybe it's for older timers like us, about, you know, when you talk about the no seed rate, it harkens back to an argument that we had in the economic threshold years of weed ecology. And, you know, there was Norris, you know, from who would say, no seed rain at all, and all the people that are into ecology, well, yes, we can tolerate some weeds, you know. And we also see the work that's come out of Australia, you know, with, you know, this idea that, you know, that we can maybe manage that. Have we kind of seen a reversal in kind of the ecological thinkers in weed science about tolerating low levels of weeds?
Yeah, it's a good point, because I was one of those graduate students sitting in there listening to Norris say, look, we need zero seed rain in barnyard grass, in rice in California, right?
Yeah.
And just thinking like, well, what a crazy old dude. And now I have become the crazy old dude. And I think it's not necessarily that we've learned to say that we want to tolerate things. It's more that zero seed rain is like this, it's kind of like exercising. You know, it's like you just keep aiming for that, and you keep trying to manipulate that where you can, because you're rarely, it's a very unusual system where it can be completely successful. The most successful ones are some of the more diverse farmers that have some short season crops, or the extreme example of the, what's the large ranch in California, Steve?
Boswell's
ranch, you know, where you know they've been reducing the seed bank for so long, and they just, you know, they're hand weeding cover crops, and they're using drones. Steve told me they're using a drone to like find where the patches of weeds are to send out the hand weeders.
Yeah.
So I think it's more of like this, you know, if you what I've experienced is if you ignore it and say, oh, we can't manage for it's zero seed rain is an impossibility, I'm not going to do it, then you just become a seed lean manager.
Okay.
And most often you see increase, you know, your lambda is positive, you have an increasing weed seed population over time. And if you at least employ some of these stresses to aim to reduce the seed bank, you can at least keep it flat, if not a lambda that's below one. That's how I would take it. But I was right there with Norris.
And maybe we've been around long enough that you can witness what's happened.
I know. I'm getting ready to get a Team Old Dude t-shirt.
Any other questions or thoughts from anything you've heard today?
Is there any role for something that would, I think, of a chemical?
chemical germination stimulant or something besides mechanical cultivation of soil that could somehow stimulate the germination at inopportune times?
Yeah, so the question is related to, is there any role for like a chemical stimulant that could improve germination? And absolutely. I mean, if you could come up with something safe, or, you know, if you could, you know, spray something right post seed rain and get things to sprout, that would be awesome. I mean, you're still going to have the dormant problem, because chances, at least based on my older reading of this, the chemicals that tend to break dormancy, other than nitrates and things, many of the other more effective chemicals tend to be really toxic. So if you can find something that's as safe as nitrates, then yeah. Actually, I haven't seen, Karen, has anybody ever sprayed nitrate, you know, on in the fall to increase germination? Yeah?
Yeah.
What's the answer?
Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Some old research, and they need hundreds of pounds per acre to kind of see a little effect. Yeah.
Well, I like your idea of robots. The young farmers that I work with on all my plots, they want them. They think you should be able to GPS it to somehow to get to the end, and then ship and come back. They're happy to have that. And solar power, because you want to get the leaf out because it's small.
You can buy one of those from France right now. There's actually one that'll do rows, and it has like traditional row, like finger weeders and torsion weeders and little brushes and stuff. And you can actually program it to like follow you, and you can set your, as you're harvesting, set stuff on it. So that's available right now. When I showed the little weeding bot to my organic farmer friend Mark there, I really thought he was going to love it. And he's like, "That's the dumbest idea I've ever heard. You get robots on my farm, I'm going to stomp that thing. I just do not like the machines taking over the farm." You know, so that was like a social dimension of this, where I was like, "Oh God, dude, I don't even understand my."
Machines at home are the least forever. Machines that think.
I should have brought that up. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you everyone for coming. I hope you got to think about weed science in a new way today. I certainly did. Got some new ideas, so...